Welcome, everybody. As we've sort of informally done, so my name's Oliver Phillips. I'm a reader here in the law school, and one of our faculty who are involved in the Centre for Law, Gender and Sexuality that is run jointly with Kiel and Kent. This is the, as some of you may know, the Centre's organising a series of conversations. This is the third in the series so far that Emma and Harriet, I think, as well, but both have been far more involved in organising than I have. The first one was on gender, international human and international human rights law. The second one, which we've already had, was on trafficking. This is the third one. And then we have another in February, in early February, on homophobia. But the objective of which is to bring together people working in both scholarly and advocacy or more applied roles in relation to each of these topics. So before we actually start the conversation, I don't actually even know if you all four know each other, if you've met before, but for the purposes of record, it might be useful to, if you could just introduce yourselves and say something about your organisation, what you do and what the objectives are, very briefly, and what attracted you specifically to this area of research or policy. So perhaps we might start with you.
Okay, I'm Adrienne Burgess. I'm research manager for the Fatherhood Institute, which was set up nearly 10 years ago. I wrote a book called Fatherhood Reclaimed in 1998, and that began a sort of, I wrote it really thinking there was no popular book on fatherhood that I could see, and I needed to look up things quickly. So I thought, well, I'll write that. But it was a kind of career opportunity. I thought somebody, Random House, said to me, would you like to write a book? And so I said, what about this book? And they said, fine. But then it became a real journey of discovery, because as I wrote the book, I realised that the question I was asking was, how is father's behaviour created? What are the forces that create the way men behave as fathers? And that came out, really, of my journey through feminism in the 1970s, when we looked as women at women as what we did and said, how did it happen that we do these things, and could we do things differently? So without taking a kind of victim stance on men, I began to look at the forces that shape their behavior, and that is a continuing journey for me. And so I'm interested, of course, in the institutional practices, the frameworks, as well as the dynamics of what goes on inside families.
Sorry, what year did you say the book was?
1997, or a couple of editions, okay. Paperback and a hardback, 1997 and 1998. And my organisation, we have sort of three areas that we collate research. We don't usually undertake research, though we do just occasionally do some action research. We collate international research, we put it into the public domain, because we did find, about 3 years ago, someone from the Treasury said to us, oh, they've got this comprehensive spending review coming up, but I mean, fathers don't have much influence on their children, do they? So we kind of put together, you know, a pretty comprehensive research review that actually looks at different policy areas and unpacks, you know, just whoosh the research and says, look at this. This is the impact that they have on mothers, on children, for good and for bad. It's very important to recognise that fathers have often a very negative influence, and that can be an absolutely amazingly important reason for engaging with them. So it's not sunny side up that dads are all wonderful. So we do that. And we do a lot of practice. We do policy work, obviously, trying to impact on national policy. And now we're trying to make sure that what happens in the local authorities is actually reflecting national policy, because we have found, of course, an enormous gap between policy and implementation. And then the third thing we do, which is related to all of those, is that we skill up family service providers so that they know how to engage with fathers, because a lot of their resistance to engaging with them is not knowing how.
Right. Thanks very much. Okay. Claire, do you want to?
Hi, my name is Claire James, and I work for the Family and Parenting Institute. And as an organisation, we cover a whole wide range of issues that are important to parents and families more generally. And So we do this policy and research work, and the ultimate aim is to improve the services that families get and the environment in which they bring up their children. We've done two major publications on fathers, one on fathers and family services and the other on specifically fathers' impact on their children's education. And then we're also interested more broadly in sort of diversity of parents. So for example, we've done books on disabled parents, bringing up mixed race children, that kind of thing. I think personally why I'm interested in the topics we'll be discussing today is that it's where the sort of very theoretical ideas of what fathers and mothers should do and what influences them meet the sort of, I don't know, messy behaviour of real people, which doesn't always fit into those theories.
Okay, well, yes, that is hopefully what we're doing today. Thanks very much, Claire. Jonathan?
I'm Jonathan Ives. I'm a lecturer at the University of Birmingham in the Centre for Biomedical Ethics. I've been conducting research in fatherhood for about 4 years now. I started when I began my own PhD work, which has now been passed. Really, I'm a philosopher. I trained as a philosopher, and I really got into this area. I'd like to say that I was quite ideologically driven, but as a graduating student, I saw that there was funding in the area, so I jumped on the funding. And as it happened, I suppose it was a similar journey to that Adrienne described. As I started asking the questions and looking at what the problems are, particularly the ethical issues in the applications of paternal rights and responsibilities, and the moral justifications for saying that this man's responsible and this man's got rights, the more nebulous a concept paternal rights and responsibilities seem to become. So I began to look closely at what philosophers have said. There's quite a lot of philosophical literature with philosophers have been quite dogmatic and saying, well, this is fatherhood, it's genetic or it's social. And I came to a similar conclusion that Claire just described, is that the philosophical theory and the ethical reasoning doesn't really fit with the way that fatherhood is practiced on the ground. So I undertook some qualitative research, and now I'm developing a normative framework of fatherhood that uses concepts of fatherhood as used on the ground, combined with philosophical theory, to try to produce a theory that allocates justly in paternal rights and responsibilities, that's both morally defensible, conceptually coherent, and is actually has the potential to work in practice, because it fits with the way fatherhood is practiced.
Nothing too ambitious there.
It's going to take a long time, but
great. Thank you, Jonathan. Sally.
So my name's Sally Sheldon. I'm currently based in the law school at Kent University, having 3 years ago moved there from Keele University. And what that means is I've spent all of my academic life in institutions which take gender research seriously. But I suppose this is probably less true now, but I think certainly historically that kind of research, when people have talked about doing gender research, generally they've meant they're talking about women. So like Adrian, I came to being interested in fatherhood through an interest in feminism. I wrote my PhD thesis on the regulation of abortion services, and that meant when I arrived at Keele, they created me as a medical lawyer. They gave me medical law to teach, and I got more and more interested in reproductive rights, but thinking about women and women's reproductive rights. And then at a certain point, it just occurred to me that there's a massive literature on women and reproduction, but virtually nothing, or very, very little, on men and reproduction. And certainly within law, and I think within ethics, that's true as well. I mean, it's so underdeveloped as a field. So I started thinking about men and reproduction. I wrote a couple of papers on different aspects of that. I found that I was reading more and more literature on fatherhood, particularly written by Richard Collier. And at a certain point, I emailed Richard and said, how would he feel about attempting a book on fatherhood and the law together? And that's because I felt by that point I was quite competent on men, reproduction and the law, but there was this huge mass of other material out there that I'd have been terrified to take on my own, whereas Richard had been ploughing a deep and relatively solitary furrow in that for some years. So that's how my interest developed. And finally, and only a little under 4 years late, we've just published a book a couple of months ago.
Which is
for the purpose of the tape.
Fragmenting Poverty, a socio-legal study.
Yeah. And I've been reading some of it and I found it very interesting, I say. Do you want to say anything? No. Do you want to say anything at this stage?
Just that I'm Harriet Samuels, Associate Director of the Centre at Westminster, and looking forward to listening to the conversation.
And echo Harriet's sentiments there. I'm very much, having heard all your introductions, very much interested to see how you're going to merge all these various different ideas, and good luck on your normative framework. And my name's Emma McLean.
Just before we start, I realised I do have some background in working with, as Sally knows, because we've sort of worked a bit together before at Keele, on gender and sexuality. And Laura, I did my first degree in South Africa in Cape Town and spent most of my time at university trying to avoid being called up into the army, which made me very interested in issues of conscription, made me very interested in issues of the military and violence and masculinity. And my work became more and more directed towards gender, and I was part of a, in the 80s, probably a very 1970s concept, which was a men's group, consciousness-raising group, that was the basis of some early research that I did that was very important to me in many ways. To cut many long stories short, much of my work has become more oriented around sexuality more recently, but I've also become a father in one of the, shall we say, typically unconventional ways that is possible nowadays. So I have to declare a personal interest in some of this at this stage. I haven't been doing actively working and researching in this area at all. So when I started looking at doing some sort of very small bit of research in preparation for today, I was quite struck by the fact that how little I did actually know about the legal aspects, and certainly also the research that is available or that has been done by you, amongst others, in this field. But looking at the proposals on joint birth registration that I was looking through on the website, it really struck me that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine that you all know certainly much more than I've been able to glean from them, but that when you put those together with the recent growth in the sort of scope of parental responsibility and the huge changes in the scope of parental responsibility over the last few years, that the two seem to have a very, unless I've misunderstood something, but have a very clear path in a particular direction. And it's almost an inevitability, in fact, of building a much more bound up concept of fatherhood, if you want, or tied in concept of fatherhood. But perhaps I'm wrong, but certainly that's the way I saw these proposals, that huge changes in the significance and the status of fatherhood as a result, legally. But that's really more a background question to, and I don't know if you wanted to comment on my understanding of the joint birth registration proposals in that, if I'm correct in that or not. But I think the questions that we're going to be approaching are bound to come up during the course of the conversation anyway, and I thought it might be useful to frame it starting with looking at those proposals and whether, have I understood them correctly, do you think? Or is there a... Because it just seems, along with the growth of parental responsibility, an enormous, it's like a bulldozer, if you want, in terms of developing the kind of legal status of fatherhood enormously. Have I understood that correctly?
Well, I sort of don't happen. I'm Australian, you see, as it happens, so I don't happen to think it's a big deal.
Oh, no, then
because in Australia they do it already.
Right.
Right, so it's like not even...
The joint birth registration.
Yeah, joint birth registration, fathers have to sign, that's the idea, right? So what it means in practice is that they ask questions if he doesn't sign. That's what I mean.
Of the mother,
if she's there.
Yeah.
But not in a horrid way. They do it in Minnesota as well. I was over in America recently. They just kind of can't understand why you wouldn't do it in a way, you know. And I mean, in Australia, I work with family services all the time. And no one seemed, because I do go over there and run training, no one seemed bothered by it, let's put it like that. No one bullies mothers. It's not about that. It's about just challenging the idea that you can simply put one name down. But also, DWP did their own research on this last year before they put this forward. And they because everyone thought, oh, the reason that these names aren't on the birth certificate is that there are these women who are trying to keep men off the birth certificate because they're all violent and, you know, it's this very difficult, poor women, right? That was the
presumption.
But the research didn't show that. It showed that this was chaotic lives, it was couples, a woman turning up thinking that she could put his name on the birth certificate, not realising he had to be there. That sort of, and therefore DWP thought, well, obviously they put in, I remember when they brought in the whole thing on child support, everyone went, oh, if mothers have to disclose the names of the fathers, they're all going to be banned. It was the same thing, the whole scare tactics, you know, and it has not been the case, you know, that because again, it's sensitive. You ask if you can, and it's really incredibly useful to identify where a mother doesn't want to give a name. I mean, we do the same thing in family services. We say to them, right, for family service, for your registration, the mother comes in, she's going to register the child. The old forms used to say, name, address, are you a lone mother? They literally said that. And if she said yes, we went nowhere, right? So from the child's point of view, we never knew in family services who the father was because there wasn't even space on the form. And in some forms, I saw one drafted for East London about 18 months ago, and it was exactly the same format, right? So this is all part of a whole thing about gathering data. And so to me, it seems absolutely obvious that when a father is born, a child is born. When a child is born, his father is born. From the child's point of view, we want to know the child, you know, unless in the most extraordinary circumstances, how could we say, from the child's rights point of view, we should not be encouraging as much as possible that name on the birth certificate. So for me, it's...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't... transgender wasn't a good idea, or that maybe bulldozer was the wrong word, but what I meant is a certain inevitability about the growth of the status of fatherhood, and almost begging the question of how could it possibly have been otherwise, which I
don't know. I think it's happening now because it's now no longer a wise child that knows its own father. I think that's the big change. You know, we can know.
Mm.
I mean, we've never been able to know before. To me, that's a big thing.
I mean, I think that the way that you frame that, Oliver, is interesting because it certainly, this reform does seem to me to follow on very logically from a lot of the developments that we've described in our book, which is conveniently 10 years after your book, Adrian, and I think it does paint quite a different picture of the current legal state of paternal rights and responsibilities. So the kinds of trends I would see there is firstly an ironing out of the differences between married and unmarried fathers. Married fathers have had an obligation to be registered on the birth, a joint legal obligation to be registered on the birth certificate for... Well, you know, as far back as mothers, as far as I know, unmarried fathers haven't. So it's ironing out one of those few remaining differences. There's a discourse of equality, I think, between mothers and fathers. So we should have the same set of expectations for mothers and fathers. There's the increase in the idea that a child has the right to genetic truth, which we've seen in all the debates about donor anonymity, as well. So I think there is a kind of and also the focus on service providers needing to involve and engage with fathers as well. So I think if you bring all of those things together, this reform looks like the logical
conclusion of all of that.
All of that. I mean, I've got some more concerns about it than Adrian has. And I suppose, I think there's two things that the government are trying to do here. One of them is to engage with fathers and make sure that people get proper information about birth registration and the legal implications of that. And the study that Adrian mentioned makes it absolutely clear that this is a disaster at the moment. So people don't find out the legal consequences of birth registration until they get into the interview with the registrar, and that's clearly wrong. Clearly people are making bad choices. So I think doing a lot more to engage with people through the perinatal services earlier and give people information is very good, and possibly that's something we're going to agree about. But the actual making the legal change, I'm less certain about that. And the reason I'm less certain about it is I think that I think there's considerable confusion about what it actually means to be named on a birth certificate in this country. So I think legally we don't know whether that's just a statement, a record of genetic fact, or whether it's a statement of social parenting roles for the future. And one reason for believing the latter rather than the former is because we've now attached the legal status of parental responsibility to birth registration. So if people are named on the birth certificate, then they get this set of legal rights which allow them to be involved in decision making over a child. And I suppose I've got my concern is that if you've got a group of men who are disengaged, not likely to be involved with the parenting, why would we want to give them that set of rights, and do we want to give them that set of rights to encourage them to get involved in parenting? So it's the conflation of those two things that make me nervous, that being named on the birth certificate as a genetic record for the child, and then these legal rights which now automatically go with it. So that's where my concern is about the reforms.
This is following on from Miss Sally, so one of my concerns about certainly the way it's framed and the way it's argued for and the way it's set out in green and white papers is that it's using a rhetoric of rights to get fathers involved, and the assumption or the hope seems to be that if we encourage or force fathers to register, we're showing them they've got rights, and then the hope is that they will take responsibilities and that they'll become fathers, and in a perhaps a more meaningful sense as opposed to the legal definition. I think the evidence base for that is not very clear, it's certainly not certain, and certainly to me from a moral perspective the rhetoric seems to be the wrong way round. It's giving people rights and hoping they'll take on responsibilities, whereas it seems to me that if we want to encourage good fathering, by which we mean the involved carer, being involved with nurture, we should be encouraging and enabling men to take on responsibilities first, and only then should we be talking about rights. If we knew that speaking about rights would lead to the enablement and encouragement of men to take on responsibilities, that'd be one thing. But I don't think we do. So I think, to some extent, the rhetoric around proposals is misleading.
I think, I'm agreeing with Sally that we've got Family and Parenting Institute's got concerns about the legal change, as opposed to a change in practice to something more like what Adrian described in Australia.
But it's built
questions.
On a legal change.
Yeah.
It's built on a legal change. You don't get the change in practice without the legal change.
But there's a lot of some of the detail in the proposals was about sort of enforcement and court cases and things. This all happening a few weeks after a baby's born. So that was more what our concerns are about. I think the question about sort of rights and responsibilities and what order they come in. The parental responsibility as a sort of having that as a legal status. If you actually look at it, it's more a list of rights, which is quite interesting. And that what is a parent? What responsibilities does a parent have? Doesn't seem to be so much attached to that. For instance, if a parent has a responsibility to ensure that their child is educated in school or otherwise, and the child's not going to school, then it would the responsibility to ensure that they do would probably be attached to, say, the parent that they're resident with, as opposed to the other one, and that would have nothing to do with who was on the birth certificate necessarily, which seems to confer more rights.
This is one of the problems, it seems to me, is that phrase in the green paper that children have a right to know that their parents take responsibility for them, and it's, I don't know what everyone thinks, but what taking responsibility means, it seems that to my mind, there's three ways in which we could read it. Taking responsibility may be simply saying, yes, I called the child to exist, it was my sperm. and that's just admitting a causal responsibility with no actual moral implications. It's just a morally neutral. And then there's responsibility to take on financial responsibility. So which I call that material responsibility, which is responsibility either to provide for the child or as a kind of duty of compensation to make sure that nobody else has to carry the cost. Or there's responsibility to be a father in a meaningful sense, to love, to care, to nurture, to be there, to make decisions, to look after the interests of. And there's those seem to me to be three very different kind of responsibilities. And I don't know if anybody here has got any take on what they're actually talking about when they say responsibility.
Well, a question also that raises, and a lot of these comments, is actually what is the distinction between, or does it matter, the distinction between fatherhood as a social status and fatherhood as a biological attribution, in the sense that when you're registered on the certificate, that doesn't require a genetic test. That just requires the testimony of the people signing it. So, there's no guarantee that is what we're talking about here, is that it's a testimony to a biological. Does that matter? Does it matter? Or does it matter that it needs to reflect a biological link, or simply the supposition of one, which is really more about the social role and responsibilities? In other words, does make somebody a father in that sense?
That actually raises another interesting point, which is actually one made by a colleague of mine, Heather Draper, and it's said that if the aim is to maintain a record of genetic truth, so if the aim of the name of the father is that we have a genetic truth, then that is justified by the fact that it's important for a child to know the truth, then it's important in every case if it's important in one. So if it's that important, we shouldn't be relying on people say they should be compulsory paternity testing at birth. And I mean, I have a right to go and get a paternity test to check that my father's my genetic father. And so if it's important in one case, it seems that it should be important in all, but it doesn't seem to be. So it seems to be a disjunct between what's going on, what's considered important for the majority, what's important for the minority.
And I presume you can't assume who also will ever know the truth, apart from through that genetic test, because, assuming one is the father of someone doesn't necessarily mean you are, of course.
Well, in adoption and in artificial insemination by donor, as we know, they're not going to mark the birth certificate, are they?
Mm.
So parents have the right to withhold this information from children of their genetic origins.
Right.
Which seems to me shockingly awful, personally. I can understand it's very uncomfortable for some parents to have to do that, but I think...
To acknowledge that they've been through the process.
Yeah, I think it's really uncomfortable, but I think that we know from the histories of adopted people how often these things come out. We know the same with AID, the row in adolescence when the father screams, "You're no child of mine." We know this is the bringing the disjunct between the theory and real life, that this stuff happens. In my view, anyone who wants to adopt should be incumbent on them. That's a condition, like you don't smoke or other things that they might look at on your own. However, I'm a bit starling.
If they're going to adopt, they should be clear about the genetics.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. You can say to people, they put all sorts of conditions on adopters.
Hmm.
All sorts of conditions. Why not that one? What's the difference?
No, and as the state is agent, one could argue that the state has the responsibility to ensure that
is said, because the child has the right to know, right? So I'm very stylist, however. I think that the responsibility means, I think that there's no pure thing by putting the name on the birth certificate. Of course you're not assuring the knowledge of genetic heritage, of course not. It's just that it gives it a bit more of a chance, quite a lot more of a chance, because when parents split up, people drift out of people's lives, at least,
But maybe
yes.
Maybe what it reflects, though, is the limits of genetic heritage, in not in the sense of their overall significance to the child, but in terms of their how much they are a part of parenting or fathering, because
well,
it's only, you know, one small part. The rest is all the right, the responsibilities, all the rights, or all the expectations, and what's the word I'm looking for? Interaction.
There is. I mean, social fatherhood, and we know that it's the same. Nevertheless, biological parenthood, motherhood or fatherhood, is a huge, huge thing.
Yeah.
And I think when we look, there's a nice book out by Gary on adopted fathers whose children were given up for adoption. So he's gone back to the 1960s, interviewed quite a lot of men. And obviously they're a self-selecting sample because he's advertised to get people to come forward. But what's quite really interesting about that is that it is not a predictor that they would... Some of the men are still... And I interviewed men like this. I've interviewed one man who'd got his name put on the birth certificate after, 60 years. Do you know? I mean, these men who are eaten up by what happened. And Gary's book shows that as well. And that what's interesting, it's not the men who... They may have been very uninvolved in the pregnancy. They may have walked out. They may have... Mm. And yet some of those, the ones who are most disengaged at that point, are, 40 years down the line, meeting the children, looking for them, And I think we shouldn't underplay. Mm. We have this kind of idea, men just scattered their sperm around. But actually, very few men. I mean, if you look at teenage fatherhood, little boy in my daughter's class about 2 years ago, she came home, she said, Stuart's girlfriend thinks she's pregnant. And all day he'd been being sick in the toilets.
Mm.
You might say, and I think that I think it is a huge thing, biological fatherhood.
Mm.
Massive. And I don't think we should underplay it from the point of view of the father or of the child. I don't think it should be rights in the sense that can't be taken away. And I think we have the child protection stuff in there for that. Same with mothers. Why should mothers... There are mothers who are totally unfit.
Then where do you separate biological from social in terms of the significance of the role, if the biological does occupy so much space?
Because then you can also achieve parental responsibility through social fatherhood or social motherhood. So, for example, parental responsibility is a given for married parents, and now for unmarried fathers who sign the birth certificate. However, several people can hold parental responsibility at once, and it doesn't detract from the person who already had it. Do you see what I mean? Not just one male person or one female person.
Mm.
I think that's really good, and I think it means that people have to think about what sort of responsibilities.
I think what two things you've said maybe show that the process of registering a birth at the moment hasn't really caught up with reality. And one is that there's an expectation it would be a man and a woman who are genetic and social parents, whereas maybe you should have, here's a man who has the parental responsibility, but here is the man who is your biological father, and so you know what your genetic heritage is and distinguish between them. Perhaps that would be, say, a donor situation. And also the fact that it's thought about as being a one-off thing, because as you say, particularly maybe younger fathers might not be engaged at first and then become more engaged, and it's not thought of as you can sort of add your name, and that's not really something that people tend to do, though they could. But
I mean, I think the other thing we have to think about is, and I think the Millennium Cohort Study research is really fascinating here. I mean, looking around this table, what percentage of parents do you think are in a close relationship, either married or living together, or we're a couple not living together, or, well, we're not a couple, but we're friends, right? So think of that scope of relationship, as opposed to we're not in a relationship, What percentage of the...
Sorry, what percentage... Can you rephrase
what percentage of couples at the time of their baby's birth, let's put it on the other way, would say, if you ask the mother, we're not in a relationship? What percentage would say, we're not in a relationship, given that the others could be married, living together, a couple but not living together, or, well, we're not a couple, but we're friends, it's okay.
Mm.
Right, so what percentage out of 100 of those parents... What percentage are not in a relationship, really, at all?
Even as friends?
Even as friends, who say, she says, oh, I don't know where he is, we're not in a relationship. What percentage do you reckon out of 100? What out of 100? What number?
Well, it's going to be a very, very small percentage.
What would you say? 20?
No.
What did you say?
I said it's pretty, it's going to be
pretty
tiny.
Pretty tiny, yes, yes.
What?
I don't know. I get the feeling of mixing it up. Maybe 2 to 5%.
2 to 5%, yeah. It's 5%.
Is it really?
It's 5%, but of that 5%, it's actually 4.4%. Of that 4.4%, 25% sign their birth certificate. 25% of the couples who are not in a relationship,
get the fathers to sign. Oh, yeah. Still,
and 25% of them are still in touch with a mother and child 9 months down the line. Mm. That's in the most disengaged group.
Mm.
1 in 10 of them are at the birth.
Mm. Which actually makes you wonder why, if it's such a tiny proportion, why this legislation is felt to be necessary.
Mm.
Because they're not signing the birth certificate. We've still got 7% not signing the birth certificates.
Of the...
7% of the whole. In Australia, it's 3.5%.
Sorry, 7% of all births are
not, signing the birth certificate.
Even though it's from such a small...
No, and it's not. A lot of the ones that are not signing the birth certificate are actually ones who live together.
All right.
Right. So it's not just the disengaged group who say we're not. I would think, I mean, of those we know. So let's say of the 7%, 3%, oh, that's of the whole, right? 7% of the whole are not signing the birth certificate. 3% of those are not in a relationship and he's not signed the birth certificate. But 4% are in a relationship. He hasn't signed the birth certificate, but they're in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And they may even be living together.
And a lot of that might just be due to lack of information.
I think so.
Mightn't it? So the non-legislative changes look to me clearly sensible.
See,
wherever you come
people
from.
Said, the registrar said to me, I was talking to some key registrar person who said, you don't get the change in practice unless you get the change in legislation.
Really?
Yes.
But do you believe that's true? Because I'm thinking it's not really the registrars you want to be targeting, is it? It's midwives, GPs. I mean, it's the people who are seeing the pregnant woman who are going to be the best service providers to give that information. Because I thought that was shocking that people aren't finding out about these, I mean, quite significant legal consequences.
Absolutely.
Until they get to that interview.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, I mean, having all of these barriers, so both the man and the woman have to be present together to sign, or they've got to get a declaration in a registered form. So it's there's a lot of
hurdles
there
that
men or that couples need to get over, and that all seems to me to be clearly bad.
Mm.
It's the legal change that worries me, and it's because I think, Adrian, you're clearly right about that people are very psychologically engaged in genetic connections. So whatever we think about them as academics or you know, whatever arguments you want to make about that, they clearly are important to children. They're clearly important to parents. So if it was a situation where we could just treat the birth certificate as a genetic record, I think I'd probably be quite happy about this. But it's having attached these legal rights to it, and it's also the case, I mean, the government, when parental responsibility for unmarried fathers became conditional on being registered on a birth certificate, what the Lord Chancellor's Department said was, because this was men making an active commitment to family life, right? And that's only 2001. They're making an active commitment to family life, therefore they should have parental responsibility, these legal decision-making rights with regard to children. And then 6-7 years later on, we've got the government saying to us, we want to work with men who are merely indifferent to being fathers, to encourage them to get involved. And we're going to do this by getting them registered on the birth certificate and therefore giving them these rights as well. So it's that shift really is the bit that's concerning me, and the granting of those legal rights to men who are merely indifferent to fatherhood, and you know, in the government's words.
But I think that we have to be really careful with all that, because you know, I don't like the term merely indifferent. People who, you know, there's quite a lot of evidence that the boys are not signing the birth certificates because they think that there's child support obligations attached to them, and the mothers are not getting them to sign it because they think there's child support obligation.
Mm.
Of course the government wants them to sign for child support. I want them to sign for child support. I think part of being a father is that you support your children. I don't, and even if you didn't intend for them to be born, still they are there.
Certainly.
And, you know, and I think therefore that the father's name on the birth certificate does have strong implications for child support. It's just easier to track him down, you know, and that's really important from the point of view of children. I think that's good. But also I think that we have to be really careful about this whole idea of indifference as though it's a state and that these men are actively indifferent, right?
Yeah.
I think very few are. And I think that what's, again, the Mahelin cohort data is just absolutely fascinating because it shows that a third of fathers who were described by the mothers as not involved and not interested at the time of the birth, a third of those are as described as involved and interested at age three,
mm.
right? And a third of the fathers who were non-resident but were described as interested and involved at the time of the birth have slipped away. So what you've got is you've got, you know, it's in and out.
Mm.
You know, and what the government is trying to do, surely, is to say, fathers matter. The midwives don't give this stuff out, I don't believe, unless they know they're supposed to be registering. Mm. The midwives have loads of stuff to give it out and they leave it in the back drawer. If it's attached to this legislative change, and I do think protection is there for mothers, I do think protection is there for children, because it's exactly, there's all kinds of other orders and things in place if people are not fit. Mothers too. Just because you're born to a woman doesn't mean she's fit to look after you.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to go back to the thing about legislative change versus other changes such as information and removing some of the barriers, because you said there is the legislative system in place in Australia, mm. and 3.5% of are still sole registration,
mm, that's right.
But here it's 7%. Now it seemed to me that just if the system's not very good at the moment, just by changing the system of information and practicalities, you could probably get it down to about 3 or 4%, not as in tackle half of the sole registrations, mm. just by that means, and therefore be similar to Australia.
But Australia, in effect, that's what all the legislation does. All the legislation does is to change the practice. That's all it does. No one's going to jail for it, any more than the women are going to jail because they won't say who the guy is so they can get child support. Do you know what I mean? No one's going to jail. It's not going to have that kind of thing attached to it, but it will have a lot of processes attached, and that's what it has in Australia. So that you don't in Queensland, you don't... She comes up, she hasn't signed. People ask questions if she doesn't know anything. You know, if they can get the father's name, then they'll write to him. And quite often she'll give him the name there and then. And then they write to him and they say, do you realise why it's important that your name be on your child's birth certificate? And it's not...
Mm.
Since I'm a little bit skeptical, I'm all for involving fathers. I think it's actually necessary. I think we should. But I am skeptical about whether this kind of legislative change will actually involve fathers in the way we want them to. So I'm assuming that by involvement, we want them to become involved, nurture fathers.
Or paying child support to start with.
Paying, yes. So either as a kind of to produce the welfare burden on to the state, or to actually be good fathers. But the evidence that the papers cited is incredibly dodgy. But all of the research in itself seems fine. But what it shows is there's an association between voluntary registration and child support payments and access or visitation,
contact,
which is not the same as involvement.
And it shows that in America, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
there's
yeah,
a whole question
a,
about whether you
it's
can
all these things are linked
it,
together.
Yeah,
yes.
And it seems that I think it's a good idea, but the entire green and white papers strike me as a very rhetorical, very noble aim, but kind of grasping at straws. There's some hope that if we change this legislation, it will change behaviour.
Well, what's wrong with changing it? What's the problem with changing it?
Well, I wonder if the money and resources could be better spent on engaging with fathers rather than forcing them to register, but whether education and engagement is going to be more effective.
I don't think it's possible. I think it's a key to education. That's what I think too. So it's only a money better spent argument. There's no other reason that you think it's really a bad idea, they're bringing that legislative change, which seems to be a pretty small thing.
Yeah.
You're saying that it's the legislation doesn't involve enforcement of that legislation. No one's going to force anyone. Not my reading of. I mean, obviously, the proposals are drafted with the idea that they don't want to be in the situation of having to force people or have a court case or anything like that, but the idea that you have to ultimately have that to sanction to back things up. And obviously, I don't know about the situation in Australia that you're describing. Whether there's just a requirement to ask and send a letter and then not follow it up, or what happens if there's a disagreement, and say the mother alleges that she's left this man because there's domestic abuse or whatever, and how do you? I don't know. It would be that very tiny number of cases. Because if it's a small proportion anyway, it'd be an even smaller proportion that this legislation would cause any problems for. I mean, you're a tiny, tiny number of people, but it's those few cases.
That's right. That's the same with child support legislation. The child support legislation says she has to give the name. Already it says that. So, and everyone said, and of course they don't have to give the name if they can show that it's clear from anyone interviewing them that it's a risk. Be exactly the same. Why would it be different?
But who is? I mean, the operation of the way that that's worked, I think, is an interesting example, because I can't remember the authors of this study now, but there was somebody who went back and looked at the way that child support officers interpreted their obligations under that, and what they found was that they did it very differently. So it was dependent on the individual, and some of them would really push women, and some of them wouldn't push women. And presumably, this is going to be the same with this kind of case. I mean, if what you need to establish not to give the name in the child support context, for example, is a successful prosecution for rape or domestic violence.
Yes, no.
But some, I mean, people were interpreting that very differently. Mm-hmm. And I suppose one of the concerns I've got about this is we don't know that detail yet. So we've got the three words. So what the DWP have said is that this should become a default presumption unless it can be shown that it's impossible, impractical,
That's
or
right.
unreasonable
That's right.
for the woman to give
yes.
the name. Now, what that actually means in practice is still very sketchy.
Yeah.
If those words, I mean, possibly those words will survive to legislation, possibly they won't, possibly there'll be a bit more detail.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, inevitably, there's got to be a lot of discretion left to individual
yeah.
registrars, which presumably means it will vary between different registrars in terms of how they enforce that. And I think we need to remember as well that this is a vulnerable group of women that we're talking about, so economically, socially, educationally disadvantaged on every available indicator. Presumably that also maps over to the group of
men,
fathers,
yes, exactly.
So the fathers will be vulnerable as well, and it's interesting that doesn't get discussed in the paperwork at all, does it? But that's got to be true as well. So it's a vulnerable group that we're talking about. We know the registrars aren't very happy about being the ones who've got to spot vulnerable women and identify that and work with that. So all of that makes me quite nervous. And it is really this conflation of the legal rights, parental responsibility, with the genetic record is the bit that's making me nervous. If it was just getting a name on a birth certificate, a genetic record for the child, I think I would feel reasonably happy with that. But that isn't how we treat birth certificates. We see birth certificates as statements of social and legal roles as well. So those are my concerns. And I share John's concerns as well, just about the research base for this. So for the DWP to rely on this one American study that actually I think shows something rather different, only shows an increase in contact without anything about the quality of that contact, and we know it's quality of contact rather than incidence of contact that's important for child welfare. That worries me, just the evidence base. Why do we think being on the birth certificate is going to achieve this? Is it really possible that we could have the increase in registration without the legal framework? I still don't know what the answer to that is, and I don't think the DWP know what the answer to that is, because they haven't got any research that shows them that. So why not do a couple of pilot studies somewhere where you try and build in that non-legislative stuff and then see if they think we need the legislation.
Is it possible to divorce the name on the, you know, the registration entirely from any social consequences or implications? Because even if you just start at the very small thing, you know, the kind of thing as remote as citizenship or, I don't know, any kind of social attribution, that, you know, it's impossible to to alienate it from any kind of baggage, isn't it? To isolate it, rather.
But we can alienate the names on the birth certificate from the biological link, can't we? Which is what we do. I mean, what we've just decided to do in the human fertilisation embryology legislation that's just come in 2 weeks ago, which is now going to allow a lesbian couple to be registered as the two parents of a child, as well as a heterosexual couple who've used donated sperm. So we treat that as a... We've decided in that context that birth certificates are statements of social, legal roles rather than genetic fact. Gender Recognition Act, you allow people to have a new birth certificate issued in their new gender identity. So it's a statement in that context, a statement of social role, gender identity rather than...
But this is why I was asking the question at the beginning, actually. If you can distinguish the social from the biological, that clearly I'm not sure that one can...
At the time of the birth, there are very, very few social fathers who are not the biological father. And that's what the Onenium cohort study. Well, at the time of the birth, there are hardly any men that would be called social fathers who are not the biological father. And if they are, and there are a few, they tend to be incredibly high risk. You know, the fact that a mother has another boyfriend by the time the birth happens is a huge indicator that there are huge problems. That's the baby P type kind of families. So, you remember, she had sex with the guy 9 months before. At the time of the birth, she's got in another relationship with another man who's prepared to take on this child. There is some, I know personally, one wonderful situation where that happened, right? But, you know, 9 times out of 10, any social worker would say to you, this is a huge indicator of problems. So it's not that we've got this nice guy who's coming along who's going to take on the child. We probably have, you know, drug use and all kinds of chaos and another man living in the house right now.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine. Are there not other, how can you say, sort of, no, I suppose not, I don't know, relationship setups that could produce a situation like that?
Terribly, terribly nice man. His wife's gone off and had an affair. Doesn't know the child's eyes.
Yeah, that would presumably be the more
common,
I would imagine. And that's nothing new, necessarily, is it?
I don't know if these things always do come out, because we know actually heterosexual couples are who've conceived using donated gametes are actually generally very successful at not telling their children, aren't we? Unlike lesbian couples where it's obvious and they're going to have that conversation at some point, and probably not like adoptive parents as well, because people around them generally are going to know the woman wasn't pregnant, suddenly, you know, suddenly they've got a child. So that prompts a situation where that information is going to come out at some point. I mean, I think the majority of heterosexual couples who've conceived using donated gametes don't tell the children.
I wouldn't say, I mean, you said that they're successful at not telling them. I said that was a massive
problem.
So I'm completely with you on that.
I'm not saying.
When they find out,
because
then you say.
It's,
I meant successful in managing to do that, not in terms of that being an example of good parenting.
Practice.
That's not what I was meaning to.
Can I ask? Cause I'm personally undecided on this, and I find it very interesting philosophically. If the reason you think that is a bad practice is because the practical outcomes and the assumption, well, eventually the child's going to find out, and because of the social, because of the way society is set up, that's going to be incredibly traumatic. So is it an outcome-based objection? Or is it based on some feeling that the child has a right, regardless of whether there's any consequences? Because I can understand the outcome-based, but it's very contingent on the parents being successful. So if we could guarantee the child would never find out, would it still be a problem? And why is the question?
Why is the problem? Well, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I was been looking at some research Susan Bollenbrook sent me very kindly, and because she gave a presentation at our conference recently, and there's, you know, there are people, the effect on people who find out is really, really traumatic. For generally, if children find out when they're very young, it's not a big deal, but later life, they just feel like my whole life's been a lie and things. And there was a mention of one girl who worked it out during her genetics class at school.
Yes, well, I've heard
tales of that. And I think that's right. And
you know,
I think
stories about
eyes
covered.
I think that's right. I think that's also right. And I think that.
But that's. I'm sorry. I don't think that answers Jonathan's question.
Well, yeah, I will answer.
Well, I would say the former for me outcomes. I don't think there's a fundamental moral right to know, or at least if there is, then that wouldn't have such a big weight with me as the outcomes.
Mm.
To me, they both have. I mean, the child's right to know and be cared for as far as possible. The child has a right, article, whatever, to know and be cared for as far as possible. To know and be cared for by both parents.
What does parent mean? No, but I mean,
they'd argue that you were caring for it by concealing the truth.
Well, potentially, but then of course, I mean, that's assuming
stability
interpretation. That is, the child has a right to be cared for and to know its biological parents, and it's the right to know the biological parents as opposed to parent as the person that they're caring. Why it's so important? I mean, I don't know. I think to some extent, it's where society set up to care about it.
I think society has been set up not to care about it, because you could, because you could have anyone's, you know, the husband, the father's name on the birth certificate has to be the man married to the mother. It's contingent on that. I don't think society has been set up at all to care about biological links, really. I think it has been to care about biological with the mother, but I think that it's now discovering biological links with the father, I would say. I think from the child's rights, it does matter, because I think there's the working out. I think there's that sense that people will say, some people won't care, like adopted children. Some will never be interested in tracing their biological parents. But you don't know which ones those children are going to be, whether they're going to be the ones who don't care, or the child who doesn't quite add up, and then they find this by donor sperm and they go, that made sense of it.
I shouldn't bang on about it, but
I think it's a question that goes to the
The argument you seem to be based on the fact that some children want to know, and wanting something doesn't mean you have a right to it. And to have a right, there must be something so fundamental, that's so intrinsic into the well-being of the child, that even if there's no negative outcome, the child is still being harmed for the right to be non-outcome links. Mm. I just think the arguments, the only arguments that work are outcome links, because the way you constructed the argument still seemed to be based on the right. The child has a right not to be harmed. And that's fine. And the harm comes from discovering it's not potentially related with the person that supposed they were related to. And because of the way society is set up, that's a harm. But that's, to some extent, a result of the expectation that the people set, that the people raising you are your biological progenitors. So if that expectation went, would the harm be removed if it became socially acceptable to have parents who weren't biologically?
I think it is socially acceptable, isn't it?
I think it's a very theoretical point that you would have a society where one didn't automatically assume that the people raising you are biologically related to you.
It is, I swear it's...
Well, no, but it goes to the question of whether parenting social or biological is what you're asking, really, isn't it? But also I think the personal, the link that you're talking about isn't entirely socially constructed, it's emotionally constructed, and so there is something in it that's not just about conventional acceptance, but that's more about an emotional state of being and their sort of habits and kind of...
It's absolutely right. People do care about it, and people are traumatised, and those are the facts we've got to work with, and we should be seeking to minimise that harm. But when we talk about rights,
you're less comfortable. I get that. I think,
Well, the earlier on, when we were beginning this, we talked about how the joint birth registration, the two of the things that really interested me that are, I don't think we've really addressed that much, are the factors, I think it was as Sally pointed out, that, but it's sort of been implicit in much of what we're saying, that the proposals do increasingly diminish any distinction between married and unmarried, parents who are married and parents who are unmarried, and also kind of move towards greater equality in terms of gendered expectations, fathers and mothers. First of all, I'm assuming we all agree with that, but what are the implications of that? Does this have anything to do with marriage, in fact? or rather, let me rephrase that, because I do think it can't. It's not going to be so easy to tear the two apart. But what is the relationship of marriage to parenting in this regard? Then, does it? What sort of role does it have to play? Does it matter that the distinction between married and unmarried people is getting diminished? I mean, clearly tabloids would have us concerned about it, but.
Is that a question of what role do we think it does play, or what role do we should play?
Well, I suppose both. Yes.
Very good.
Yes.
I think it depends very quickly what marriage means to the individual. I think it's very hard to make a generic, or to give a generic answer to that, because to some people, marriage involves a promise and a commitment to procreation, where some people just see it as nothing to do with family but to do with the commitment to the partner. So if somebody views it in the formal way, then marriage may be an important sign of commitment to any future children. But not everybody views it.
So the legislation, therefore, or the proposals, therefore, take the position that has no impact in terms of marriage, presumably, because if it allows for that, you know, to allow for a situation where people's individual choices in that regard can play.
Actually, to be honest, I've not thought it through.
The proposals do, don't they, keep the situation where a married mother can turn up and the father is automatically registered. So it's taking the position that if you're married, then you've already committed yourself to your first scenario, that involves that you've sort of taken on some responsibility already. So it is saying that. It's not saying that people can't make other forms of commitment, but it's kind of taking the assumption that marriage is a form of commitment which is sufficient for the moment.
But of course you can escape that commitment if you can prove the child's not genetically
yours, that's right.
Which is interesting. So marriage actually doesn't seem to play well, or certainly not the role it once did.
And now we're much happier with allowing men to rebut that presumption as well, aren't we? So the law used to make it incredibly difficult for a married man to say
to discern some children that were supposed to be his.
You had to actually be able to demonstrate that you'd been out of the country for 10 months. That's how.
It was
of that.
Yeah,
you had to show it. It's evidence.
Yes. And it changed.
Yeah, and it's changed. I mean, partly obviously because of the science and the DNA testing, which makes it very.
But there was a presumption of fatherhood if you were married. In other words,
absolutely, and it was incredibly difficult to rebut that presumption, and partly for concerns of public decency, because you didn't want married couples being able to allegations of extramarital relationships,
and it stopped lots of children being illegitimate in the eyes of the law. This presumption is.
But that's been. But the new proposals don't have that. I mean, they distinctly, the opposite is the case from what you're saying. One of you saying just
well,
now.
What the courts tend to say now is that they take the idea, the child's idea, to know its genetic inheritance very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So that they will almost always say it's in the child's best interest to know the genetic truth, even if that's going to be proving that this man who. The child has always thought was his father isn't his father. And there's one quite interesting case with a child, I think of 11 or 12, who's really saying, I don't want a paternity test, I don't want the DNA test, I don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts tells the social worker to go off and explain to the child why this is in the child's best interest to have that information. So there's a really strong emphasis on the genetic truth being in the child's
best
interest.
It's not just the medical stuff now, isn't there? So genetic truth is... also
it's medical.
Then
none of us have a right to our genetic medical history in that way.
No.
So I couldn't force my mother to give me information if I thought there was a family predisposition to breast cancer or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't have a right to that information. I mean, you might think she's acting wrongly if she doesn't give me that information. But I don't. I mean, your question, Oliver. This is one that I struggle with actually, because I think one of the things that I like about the development of the law is I think the way that we think about fatherhood now is much more it's a direct, unmediated relationship
with the child
rather than being a commitment that you owe to your wife or female partner. And I think that's a positive thing. But the evening out the differences between married men and unmarried men, I think is difficult because, I mean, as Claire said, with married men, law makes this assumption that there is a commitment there, and that might be a bad assumption in some small number of cases. Maybe you're committing to the partner and not to the child, but I think it's slightly easier to generalise about that group than it is mm-hmm. about a group like unmarried fathers, because at one end of the spectrum you'll have unmarried long-term cohabitees. Father may be the primary caretaker, he may even be a sole caretaker at some points, and that group is going to look the same as married men, I think, long-term cohabitees. At the other end of the spectrum you've got one-night stands, there's just that whole range of humanity there, and how law deals with that, I think, is a really difficult question. Who do you regulate for? What assumption do you make? Do you assume commitment and therefore give the rights that go with that? Do you assume non-commitment and therefore require those men to prove themselves? And I think that's a really, really thorny
problem. Yes, because, I mean, just because it's been a one-night stand doesn't mean that once he discovers he's going to be a father, he doesn't want to make a commitment, or could, with the slightest encouragement. I mean, I have a lesbian couple who found a donor, right? And the deal was he wasn't going to have anything to do with raising the child. That was the deal. And when the child started asking about the father, they wrote to him. He now has shared care of this child. You know, human beings are very.
I think it's very difficult for people to imagine in advance, if they haven't had children, how they're going to, whether they are going to be able to distance themselves from the way they anticipate. Or, I mean, similarly, the opposite of that. I actually know a chap who had a very drunken one-night stand with a woman that he never thought he'd see again in his life. And a few years later, saw her walking down the street with a child that was clearly his. She'd deliberately set out to produce the situation, but hadn't said to him, "Do you mind?" I was quite indignant on his behalf. But I remember my partner saying to me, "No, it's his fault. You know, he should have, taken greater care of himself." I was thinking, but once the child is there, then somehow there's it's different. But it is. I mean, laws are a very blunt instrument with which to try and cope with all these, huge varied situations.
Yes.
But it suggests that the constant threat is clearly that you're putting the interests of the child first, or are you? I mean, I like the fact that it is an increasingly unmediated relationship, father and child. I think that's a huge advance.
I think that. I can see from the point of view of the service providers that I work with all the time, I can see that this could make a huge difference, right? Because they, at the moment, they're so cavalier about this, about fathers, and they, if they knew that, if the midwives and everybody knew that it was on the cards that he was supposed to be on the birth certificate, then they have to talk to him differently. At the moment they can, there's a thing coming out, and it's from the Department of Health or someone like, not only the Department of Health, it's for all new mothers, right? It's got everyone, it's called Mum Plus One. Right? That's what the publication is called, Mum Plus One.
Oh, and that's but presumably because they want to be inclusive of...
No, well, Mum Plus One is the baby.
Oh, but the one is the baby.
Yes, okay. That's the couple. So, right, and that just kind of... there's a publication coming out that's going to be given to every new mother. It's a very important publication.
Yeah.
Oh, it's from MIDEARS, the Midwives Information Service, that's right, but funded through government. It's a big thing. And it's called Mum Plus One.
Mum Plus a Baby.
Plus the baby, right? So what it's this whole idea of this couple... Like a virgin.
Oh, I see.
This is the couple, right? So what? And that's actually where the thinking lies. It lies through, through all the services. It lies through early years. It lies through health. That if the father is there, that they're having to think about him because his name is going to be on the birth certificate. They have to help his name go on the birth certificate. They have to think about him. That also means that they will assume that when a mother comes to register a child at a children's centre, that there will be a father's name. Mm-hmm. They will assume that rather than at the moment. They have these incredible fantasies. When I ask that question, how many couples do you think are not in a relationship at the time of the birth? They will say to me, 35%. They believe that.
Mm.
And they're not, and even in their populations.
beginning to understand what you're
saying now.
Because it is, I think, a big problem involving men and fathers in the prenatal and antenatal care.
Mm.
It's very much directed at women. That's what, what I was saying about resources being better spent elsewhere. When I make it a law, when if you can involve men and fathers from the outset and get them, because of course the mother begins a relationship at day one, and they're a mother in some way, right?
Mm.
The way through gestation, and it's easy to form a relationship. Whereas one of the reasons men feel somewhat disconnected is that they've not had that. There's a very physical barrier between them and the child, which is the mother, and there's also the social barrier because they're treated as not so important. So, but if you're right, and if the fact that the care workers and people involved and the maternity services see the legal requirements, then that forces them to consider
it. That's all.
The father, then I'm with you. I mean, I think it would be good if there was an evidence base for that, and if we could see that would work, but in principle, yeah, I'm with you there.
And I think the important thing about the evidence is do no harm, really.
Mm.
You know, and I suppose I feel that's going to be okay, because I don't think it does harm in Australia the way I see it done, and also, because I think that was the child support argument, and then I haven't heard anyone say in all the time that child support's been in, that it has done harm to women, and so I can't. So I am very acutely aware of the do no harm. Right, I'm not convinced that I've heard a good argument that by putting the father, by making it a requirement, you know, that the father's name go forward, that is going to do harm. If it's not going to do harm, it is going to do harm, and I don't see the likelihood that it will, given past experience. Can't be sure, but on balance.
I do still, with Sally again on in saying that it seems certainly morally, whether it's particularly problematic, remains to be seen, but morally problematic associating rights with registering, so giving men rights on the basis of this act, and as progenation, I'd be far happier if registration and being a genetic father was a marker of responsibility.
I think it is.
It is, but then rights shouldn't come straight away. Rights should come once you've discharged a responsibility. I'd be more comfortable with that.
But I think that we have to recognise that even though people have non-resident fathers have parental responsibility in law, the exercise of parental responsibility is incredibly difficult.
Mm.
And that, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law.
I was about to say that, actually. I mean,
yes.
You know what you just said now about the physical barrier. Certainly,
yes.
You know, when the child's born, the father has no relationship with that child and has to build one. And that involves a whole negotiating, a whole dynamic with the mother about access, and not just access, on what terms access, and which is incredibly complicated, I think, even within an intimate relationship. And so
that's exactly right.
Yeah, there is, you know, there's, it's, I don't know what, that's why I think this notion about equality between mothers and fathers, you can't presume that at all, I think, certainly for the first few years. So which raises the question of what role should the law be playing in that regard? And immediately you're confronted then with the whole range of, you know, how do you cope with all the range of relationships? But should we be expecting it to be providing a kind of framework for moving towards positions of equality? You know, in theory, I would have strongly been, you know, arguing that, in the sense that I do think structurally, conditions of employment, maternity, paternity leave, all the stuff like that should, yes, there's a lot of work to do, but the reality is that it's very, very difficult to build that fatherly relationship if you're not, you know, how can I say, effectively open all, you know, all avenues of negotiation open, so to speak.
As you say, even within an intimate relationship, even living in the same house, it can be
hard. It takes one, yeah.
And I think it's also interesting that what technology is doing with bringing men in to the births, not just being at the birth, but I mean the experience of the scan for men. You know, my father never had that. You know, I was presented to him, right? But there's ample evidence from research of the impact of the scan on men and on women, because actually, even though you do give birth and you so-called have this relationship with this baby inside of you, I actually think you don't. I think you have a relationship with a fantasy baby, and I think once that baby is born, even for a mother, it's generally a tremendous shock. You know, I had a baby who was not what I expected. I expected this little dark baby, and I, you know, cloning myself, yeah. And I get this big fair baby. That's a real, you're renegotiating. You know, you're negotiating the relationship with this real person. And that's why bonding doesn't happen for all mothers straight away. You know, it's not that you've got this relationship, but all it comes out, ah, oh, here we are, we know each other. Mm. Sometimes it is like that. Mm. But sometimes for men it is like that. They hold that child and will say, you know, I felt we'd known each other for a long time.
Mm.
Mm. So it's not a completely simple.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I guess. Sorry, Clive.
Yeah,
too.
Well, and I was just thinking about the things you were talking about, Adrian was really saying about the certain maternity services and relationship with fathers. And I think the culture, both in the terms of the support services and in terms of sort of how mothers and fathers see their roles, I think, you know, legislative change can be very important and symbolic, but it's such a tiny part of that.
Mm.
And so, for instance, there might be a father who is married to the mother and, you know, very sort of respectable, and you definitely think he was going to be involved. And there might be a midwife who doesn't actually look at him while she's talking.
Oh, yeah,
and that sort of cultural shift is a much bigger thing.
Yeah. And I don't think it's either or. You know, I think the legal stuff is is important cogs in the wheel, and sometimes can give the green light for other behaviours, right? And that actually that stuff needs addressing, but completely.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things at the Family and Parenting Institute we've been kind of banging on a bit about is health visitors and postnatal support, and that's the sort of quality of that and the quantity. And because you mentioned, you know, mothers don't always bond with their babies. Sometimes they have postnatal
depression,
and it's really difficult time for the couple. And although you talked about the fathers having the direct relationship in law with the child, it is a three-way thing, and it can just all that sort of new person in the relationship. It's not mom plus one.
No, it's not mom plus one. It's completely crazy mom plus one. Not mom plus one. That's right. Poor mum. If you make it mum, how ghastly is that?
Absolutely.
I mean, to me, well, that's just
appalling.
Poor
both of them, probably, actually.
Yeah.
It's not a good.
I mean, just.
But on the birth registration suggested change, then, Adrian, would your argument be that you're only worried about the legal change as a way of facilitating all the other?
No, I do think that from all the things, I mean, I know you don't like the rights article, but I think it's really very good for a child to have the best possible chance of knowing, having their name on the birth certificate. You know, knowing that we know that quite a lot of those couples are going to slide apart, you know, and mothers will tell the children that their father's dead, or, do you know what I mean? It's just a kind of, it's good that it's there.
Okay, so it's a combination.
It's a combination of things. That's for me.
Yeah.
And also because I don't, and I have really thought a lot about this and I can't prove it, but I don't think it's going to do harm. Right.
Can I just ask you, both Oliver's out of the room, what happens in Australia about lesbian couples? Because that was surprising to me that
know.
The DWP, that just doesn't seem to have occurred to them as an issue, that they're going to have lesbian couple-headed families who don't want a man named on the
birth
certificate,
certificate
because of the legal rights that goes with...
The
that.
Thing is, they've had this thing of the fathers. They had, first of all, before us, they got this quite a long way back in the 90s. They got this. I think it was 1992. They got this thing where the father's name on the birth certificate gave him parental responsibility, right? And then very shortly afterwards followed
you know, it was logical that then you should try to get his name on the birth certificate, will sort of follow. So there's a very strong lesbian lobby there. So I don't know what their position is, whether you can hide the.
It doesn't seem. I mean, it doesn't seem to have occurred to them. That's not one of the examples they give for it being unreasonable to.
Can I interrupt that? If a lesbian couple starts a family via an HFE licensed clinic, then there is no man to go on the birth certificate. So the problem is only when it's an informal.
That's right.
Yes, because the child would have a right to know, wouldn't they, at the age 18, if they used a clinic?
Yes.
Yes. So it's the same as a married couple.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be open for the lesbian couple to say, "We don't know," and there's actually no comeback to that.
Right.
None at all. Which is why it has
same as adoption.
So yeah, and it's kind of connected with this idea of fatherhood becoming less mediated, but in a sense it is, even with this legislation it is still mediated. The mother is still very much the gatekeeper, because she can still say I don't know, and it's going to be very difficult to pressure the new mother. There's issues of the vulnerability there. The registrars, certainly judging by their response to the Green paper, they wouldn't feel comfortable pressing the mother for this. But if there's a legal requirement, and if it's a child's right, then surely they should, and the woman should be pressing. It's a very, very difficult ethical tightrope between the child's rights and the need not to pressure mothers, and the simple fact that you're not going to torture a mother to get it out.
Yeah.
She says,
"I'm not telling
don't
you."
No.
Yes.
Then you've got to accept it.
Yes,
and
but you asked the
it.
Question. That's the point is,
yeah.
You've asked the question, so she's had to think about it. She might say it's impossible.
Yeah.
No, she can easily say, "I have no idea."
I wonder how convincing that is for a lesbian couple who've DIY insemination, though, because that by the nature of it is going
to
be...
Well, they're going to have to talk about it.
Yeah.
They can't.
Well, inevitably, it's a very explicit decision beforehand. If you want to do this without a father involved, you don't do that by accident. It's an explicit, very deliberate
decision.
Well,
you might have your own idea of what the father being involved means, mightn't you, that you want to negotiate between the three of you, which doesn't involve the name on the birth certificate and the rights that go...
You're thinking about someone who chooses who they want as the father, but they don't want that fatherhood acknowledged. So
formally, legally, with the rights.
Or in any way, presumably.
My sense is for lesbian couples with a known donor, that's going to be a much more context-specific arrangement where they talk about...
And if it's a known donor, then...
And if they've got the sperm off the internet, or
exactly.
Well, they just have to say, "I don't know."
But then, surely the same applies to accept it. I don't think you can. I'm not sure they can do it legally here. What gay men who have a surrogate, a male couple who have a surrogate, who have a woman carry a child for them.
I don't think they'd be able to go down, because it was specifically lesbian couples. It said, didn't say that gay male couples can go down as both parents. Did it?
Gay men. So they're extending the fast track adoption possibilities following surrogacy arrangements under the legislation. So at the moment, married couples where one of you has a genetic link and you've hired a surrogate, or you have a surrogate who's carrying a child for you, there's a fast track adoption possibility after the child's been born. That means you don't have to go through all the same hurdles as other adoptive parents. So that's being extended to unmarried, same sex,
heterosexual
couples.
Okay. It's being extended from married heterosexual couples to unmarried heterosexual or homosexual couples.
Both unmarried heterosexual couples and same-sex couples, whether
same
simply partners
gay
or
lesbian.
Otherwise.
Yeah.
Including men,
Can I ask a question? If this is a legal requirement for mother to name, and if she knows, if the authorities suspect they do know and they're just not saying, are there any... Is there any proposal for punitive measures?
Not against the mother, was there? There was discussion about whether fathers should be.
Yeah, I mean,
or
say in the case of lesbian and the mother families, the birth mother, it would be difficult to take punitive measures on her, but her partner.
The female partner.
She's withholding information. She's technically legally obliged to give. I mean, you can't send the birth mother to prison.
She wouldn't be legally obliged, though. So the obligation to register a birth is, at the moment, it's all mothers and married fathers, isn't it? They have the legal obligation, so they'd be the only people that you could find. There was some discussion about whether fathers should be fined if they refuse to be named.
Yes, that's right.
But with
the lesbian couple, surely two lesbians could get married and have an officially recognised, what's it called?
A civil partnership. Yeah.
So presumably the one of the lesbian couple could go along with what's the equivalent of a marriage certificate and say, we are the parents of this child. Wouldn't that be right? I mean, at the moment, a married father can go along with the marriage, with the birth certificate, and register the baby. The mother doesn't have to do it. I mean, as long as you're married, either person can do it, right? So presumably among lesbian couples, as long as you take your civil partnership...
The non-biological mother could do it. I mean.
But or either of them. Well, presumably they don't have to birth either.
I don't think that's right, because I think at the moment we take marriage as a proxy for genetic
fatherhood. Yeah, but we don't take a civil partnership as a proxy.
Because, yeah, for biological reasons.
I see. So a civil... Yes, right, okay.
We don't think motherhood's about genetic links either. Actually, interestingly, so the legislation, Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act, actually has a clause that says you can't become a mother by virtue of having donated an egg for that child. It's got to be a gestational connection. So the way we think about motherhood and fatherhood is importantly different, actually. It's gestational connection for mothers and genetic links or something else. Or something else.
Legally, it's moving, I'd say, towards the genetic links, with the exception of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act, which still wants to protect the nuclear family. And this, I'm struggling with this enormous inconsistency.
Well, and also has retained the distinction, very important distinction, between married and unmarried couples, and now civilly partnered same-sex couples and non-civilly partnered same-sex couples, which I think is very interesting when that distinction is being really obliterated everywhere, or very significantly eroded. Why would they keep that?
It's not still Baroness Warnock, is it?
Legacy of the Warnock.
Yeah, it is. Well, they've updated that piece. I think it is because they updated the old legislation rather than writing a new one. I don't think that would be in there if they started from scratch.
But, I mean, there is research that shows there was a people policy and technology report, or something, I can't remember, a while ago, that showed quite clearly that commissioning couples, people looking for sperm donation, they try very hard to match donor characteristics. I mean, in America, Cynthia Dan Bill's book Exposing Men, she's got a big section showing that there's an entire in the industry, and prospective recipients can get catalogues where they're punched. So there is this whole industry and trying to hide the fact of donation and trying to protects the image of the nuclear heterosexual and biologically related family. And that's very much enshrined in the HFE Act, but it's completely ignored, or it's becoming less important elsewhere. And it's a shift from focus on the family to the individual, the child, and maybe that's reflective of a general shift towards individual rights. From social responsibility and familial responsibility. I find it interesting that where there's medicalisation, where there's medical technologies involved, we want to pretend it's not there. Which I find very curious.
You two want to
something more comment really than anything else. I suppose the thing that just fascinated me the most, not I haven't really got an academic interest in the issues, but I am a parent, so from that point of view I've got an interest. But I think it was Jonathan's comment at the beginning really about how the legislative framework doesn't necessarily, or the, I think it was a philosophical framework, doesn't match the messiness of everyday life.
Yeah.
And was that yours? And I was just I was really fascinated by that throughout, I suppose, and I was particularly interested in the issues about how women mediate, how the mother mediates or has to mediate between the child and the father. And I was thinking about things like Adrian was saying about how, you know, fathers may not be interested when the child's born, but then they become interested when they're three or when they're six. Mm. And just how would that play out in everyday life if you're the mother and you're the primary caregiver? I don't know if I was the mother whether I would say no, come back later when I've raised them or when they're raised.
Yeah.
The issues about, you know, what is the child's right when you may have a father from outside who's barely interested. I can't remember the term used, indifferent, flitting in and out. And how that might actually be really disruptive to the family. So I had a lot of interest in the idea of the sort of the messiness of, and the realities, and how I think it's very difficult to be very prescriptive.
Mm. But it's how you make good legal principles on that
basis,
isn't it? Who you're regulating and how you cope with that sheer mess of life. And actually, that's the significant theme or the key insight really that came out of writing that book with Richard is what we call the fragmentation of fatherhood, so that there's this bundle of rights and responsibilities that law has and it gives out differently on different bases. So you might think one person should be liable for child support, the child might have social relationships with, you know, two or three men, a genetic father, a mother's current partner, I mean all sorts of different people, and how that happens. So I think trying to cope with the messiness is a significant challenge for
Are they making the right legal principles though? Because I got the sense that there was disagreement that there was a role for law but not necessarily the role that was etched out in the proposals. So
I think that most speaking for everybody, sorry. But I think that most people have agreed that the aim is right, but I think where some of us are sceptical about the effect that the legislation is going to have. So I think Adrian's probably more positive and
you're cynic.
That it's going to change. I'm slightly more cynical.
I also think that it's very easy to think that if you're going to make a change in the law, you're somehow making the law, when actually the law you've got at the moment is also making the law.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know? And it's very easy to think, when actually what it's doing already is active. It's actively saying it doesn't actually matter. You, the mother, can register the name of your child. No one's going to ask if you just put your own name on the birth certificate. No one's even going to blink an eyelid. That's what the law does now.
Mm.
And the law is actually therefore ruling that fathers are absolutely optional extras and that this is the mother's decision.
Mm.
And that's a position.
Because we haven't talked explicitly really about the symbolic value of legislation,
right,
have we? And I think that is incredibly important, and it's such an important focal point for different campaigning groups as well. So the anger at differential treatment, I think, is very much there.
I wondered if the rhetoric of rights is aimed to some extent at appeasing the father's rights.
I bet it is. I mean, I hate the father's rights stuff. I hate the language of rights.
Mm-hmm.
Something I never even go for. I do use for the child a bit more. I just do feel that a child needs every chance in life to know who my real parents are, because children use those terms all the time. They always use that term,
but they use them differently, don't they? Because I think that was one of the interesting things reading some of the responses in the donor anonymity debate, is some children will say my real parents, meaning the sperm donor, and some will say my real father, meaning the guy who was there to get up in the middle of the night and get me a glass of water. And and the thing I find interesting about that is the idea that you can only have one real father, because I think that isn't what law's doing. Law's got this very nuanced view of fatherhood and different kinds of rights and responsibilities. But I think psychologically people tend to think one mother, one father.
Mm.
So that real authenticity is really about exclusivity there, isn't it? You can only have one of...
Yeah.
Although I do think that is increasingly challenged, and people do take that challenge on board. I mean, in different contexts, you know, but certainly.
But one really interesting thing about the human fertilisation embryology legislation, so extending parenthood to lesbian couples, you have the mother and you have a female parent. That's the second parent is called a female parent, because we can't
possibly call it a father.
Because, well, there's a provision in the law that says references elsewhere in law to fathers shall now be taken to include
female parents.
Yeah, so they are effectively parents. But I find that fascinating, the idea that you can't have two mothers, because that we just can't compute. That they're what on earth a female parent is, if not
a
mother.
Mm.
Is interesting,
will
isn't it?
Will they be liable for... In Australia, I do know that the female parent, the other female parent, has not been liable for child support. I do know that, which is really interesting. They must have... I'm just coming back to me now.
Mm.
They must already have a possibility of having that other... the female parent already on birth certificate. I think it must be, because I remember seeing some stuff about... that they're about to change that. Because that was sort of a loophole,
right?
So I don't know here whether the female parent will be liable for child support
if she's on the birth certificate.
Well, I would thought
so.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're saying that in Australia, they're just about to change it so the female parent would be.
Yes. I happened to see something about that recently.
Mm-hmm. Sally, do you think we are actually at the stage where in law they're recognising two fathers and they're calling them fathers, or are they recognising that different men have various salient roles to play and they can be involved? I mean, my thought would be they're stopping short of actually calling all these men fathers.
Well, the birth certificate is the stopping point, isn't it? So
yeah.
You can only have two names on the birth certificate, but you're giving different men, I mean, parental responsibility,
yeah.
So they're being recognised as a parent, and whether that's the same as being recognised as a father or not,
yeah.
I don't know now. So you can have these different roles shared out in that way, but still the birth certificate.
They've been very much against, hasn't it? Big move against stepfather adoption, hasn't there? That's been really diminishing. It used to be, it's very hard to get a stepfather adoption now, I think. They want to give them parental responsibility, they don't want to... They used to be quite easy to get a stepfather adoption.
And that's because of
because
open adoption and wanting to maintain relationships.
No, it's just
with the birth
that even if
family,
that, you know, that? Yes, not in the sense of adoption as in the sense of from the birth, you know, but I mean, if a mother has a child with a man who is the birth father, and then she partners with somebody else, and then she and her new partner want him to adopt the child, that used to be really easy.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of adoptions were stepfather adoptions.
Yeah.
And I believe this. One of the reasons that the adoption statistics have gone down is not just the unavailability of babies, but also the fact that stepfather adoption is now not so.
But I think that's because you can't, for a stepfather to adopt, you have to extinguish the rights with
the
birth
father.
And I think that
they don't want to do
that fits with
now.
Our thesis of fragmentation. That what law is trying
Absolutely.
To do is maintain the relationships with
all
of
everybody.
those men. So the relationship with the stepfather is very important, but you deal with that through parental responsibility rather than.
Which would seem to reflect real life.
What's the messiness of real life,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
But holding on to the number two is the significant. You can only have two parents, even you know, notwithstanding the messiness of real.
Yeah.
Of real life.
And actually, I mean, that kind of, if a child has two, as it were, father figures, but that is quite a stable situation. Although it's different from the traditional one, I would think it would probably be. Result in a much more sort of stable, happy upbringing. It's more the sort of change, we have one, but that keeps on changing over time. So I think
it's,
as you were saying, really, it's a, you could have, it's the not having relationships with people, but having them in a reliable way and not having them broken. I think that's what's probably the most important for children's well-being, that feeling of not being rejected.
I mean, unreliable behaviour in the non-resident father is a serious indicator of poor outcomes for children. So the non-resident father being unreliable, but then also multiple family breakdowns, crucial. So a change is one stepfather you can about cope with. Do it again.
Exactly.
You know.
Going back to that problem of the unreliable non-resident father, I mean, I would want to say that in virtue of being unreliable, that man should actually have no rights.
Well, or else what we should first be looking at is why he's not reliable.
You see, this is what we tend to do. Mm. If it was a mother who was not being reliable,
yeah.
we go, now what can we do? Of course she loves her child. Let's see what supports we can put in place to help her be the best mother she can be. If he's not reliable or his behaviour is negative, we go out of the picture if we possibly can. No one goes, let's deal with this. You know, and with some of those men, you will change it quite quickly. With some men, you will never change it.
And who, yes. do you think that's still true? Because I think that's clear, that was
yes.
clearly the case when you wrote your book.
Mm.
And 10 years later, having just finished our book, I mean, it seems to me that there's such a focus of policy attention on men and involving men in the families and trying to tie men back into the to the family. I mean, it might not be working very well.
Well,
I'd
say in services, it's absolutely not happening.
Right.
So, for example, there's a new piece of research out by the Family Rights Group where they have gone through the care, they've gone through, I think it's in Southampton and I think Lewisham, they've been looking at the case notes of children who are must be on the child protection register or, you know, case social work cases, and seeing where the name of the father is there, and many cases it's not there. When it is there, it almost never has. I think in only 50% of cases where it's even there, does it have do they have contact details? So and the research, in fact, I was talking to the woman who did the research, who said she was a social worker 20 years ago, she's now a researcher, and she said it hasn't changed.
Mm.
So I don't know.
Mm.
I don't know. But I would say certainly from the social care sector, the evidence is that it hasn't changed.
Mm. It seems to be there at the level of government
yeah.
policy and concern, doesn't it? But maybe not.
But not in practice. In fact, the DCSF, have just done a piece of research which they published at your conference, was in our PACs,
mm.
which showed, they did an analysis of their own policies and showed how absolutely inconsistent they were. So some policies coming out saying about involving fathers, and then the next day another piece of policy comes out and it calls about parents and doesn't mention them. So policy is inconsistent, and then implementation is miles away. So that the children and young people's plans for the local authorities, almost none of them reflect the government stuff on fathers. So
mm.
children, young parent people's plans in the local authorities are written in terms of parents, and fathers are not mentioned.
Mm.
Yeah, so there you have a huge disjunction.
Mm.
Can I ask you, if the aim, I think everybody would agree, is optimal child welfare. Do you think it's possible to say there's a point when intervention to try and get fathers to care is not working. And the same should certainly be true of mothers.
Oh,
so
it is.
The idea of is the same interventions to be given to both.
Well, I'm not with the same. I mean,
equal effort.
Yes, you should be putting in tremendous effort. There's no reason not to put the effort into the fathers, in my view. And yes, some of them you won't get in, and in some cases you'll know within 5 minutes of meeting them that this is an absolutely dreadful situation, and you'd have to do an incredible lot of work. He's got bipolar disorder and he's taking loads of drugs, and you know, yes, of course. And there are plenty of child protection concerns that deal with those situations.
Yeah.
We don't have to worry about that. You know, they're there. The systems are in there.
They don't always work. That's what I was putting
in
face.
Yeah. What I mean is, in terms of the legislation and everything, the systems are in there to deal with that, and also we know that people won't pursue them. Yes, and that,
yeah.
of course.
So it's one. I mean, one worry that I've got about rhetoric of rights is related to the point that Harry made, was you're giving rights to unreliable fathers who may show up sporadically and ask for rights and be disruptive. Where might it be easier at some point and better for the child to say at some point you've got no?
Of course, the parental responsibility doesn't confer the right to contact. There is no right to contact inbuilt to parental responsibility. Do you know that?
I thought there was.
No,
so,
absolutely not.
Well, and I was thinking, presumably at some stage, if a father's having an impact on a child's life is that negative, then there are all sorts of measures that you can take to
yeah.
intervene to prevent.
But there isn't a connection between PR and a right to contact.
I think it puts you in a privileged position to apply for contact.
You can apply for contact.
Doesn't it? So it's easier to...
Well, you can't apply. It's very hard to apply for contact. It doesn't give you a privileged position. It just puts you in a position where you can apply for contact. I mean, normally, if a father wants to apply for contact, you would say, get PR first.
Is it automatic with mothers, then? Has a mother got to apply for it?
No, because I mean, if a baby's taken away at birth, say, from a mother who's deemed to be not fit, of course she doesn't have a right to contact.
But she's got parental responsibility.
Yeah, she still has parental responsibility, but not the right to contact. Because in the child's best interest, it would be deemed.
Thanks for clarifying. I've been living under misapprehension for a while.
I'm aware, I'm afraid, that time's no longer on our side. It's marching on. So. But of course, I don't know, some of you may have to rush off. Unfortunately, I have to go and see my daughter. perhaps just in conclusion, I wondered if there's anything that the four of you would particularly want to sort of say before we all go apart, other than what I'd like to say, which is that I hope that it seems to me that there's a lot. I've learned a lot from the conversation today, and I'd like to think that. It's just the start of some communication between four of you working on similar areas.
It's been a great opportunity, I think.
Yeah, it has.
It's been absolutely fantastic.
Well, it's a very exciting time in the field as well.
Yeah.
Really, so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for organising it.
Thank you. Yes, you'd be great.
Sit there and press buttons. Speak of which, press that button.
It's not to be underrated. I'm overrated.
Well, exactly.
After a little easy to screw up.
It is indeed, unfortunately.